Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science, and we do have some real science for you today. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Last week, a caller wanted to know about fire retardants and their health and safety issues. And, you know, honestly, I really came up blank. It was a very good question, and I don't know the answer. So I promised to get back to you this week. And that's how we're going to start this program, talking a little bit about fire retardants, the issues, the concerns, and then pinging on to a couple of other science issues that relate to it. So let's start with talking about fire retardants. First of all, the term needs a little bit of definition because there really are two classes of fire retardants. One is the class that is put in products. And so let's call this the 911 fire issue. Children's pajamas have fire retardants on them. Polyurethane foam, which is used in couches, has fire retardant applied to it. There is fire retardant in the plastic cases of your computer, of all sorts of places, hair dryers, fax machines. And these fire retardants are not the topic that we're going to be discussing today. There have been, and will probably continue to be, findings showing that these chemicals, which are really new-to-nature molecules, and I'll come back to why that's an issue in a moment, are a concern. They bioaccumulate in the environment. They do seem to be stored in human fat tissue, and it has implications as far as neurological development in children. We had an issue, polychlorinated biphenyls. These were banned in 1976, but they're still in the environment. These things, once they get into the environment, because they're new-to-nature molecules, they may not have a way of being broken down naturally, and that can be a problem. The other problem with these is that it takes a while before you can figure out whether there's an issue with them, and volume is always going to be key. By definition, you can't study long-term effects in the short term, and that's always an issue when you invent a new molecule with a new purpose. Secondly, our bodies have excellent detoxification systems. Our bodies are set up to break down molecules, and even new-to-nature type molecules do eventually get broken down in body tissue, although somewhat slowly. So how much, what the body burden is of a compound, how much you get, and more we're beginning to understand at what age you get it, the younger being the worse, are also keys to whether or not these things are harmful or not. Now, if you'd like to know more about your body's own natural defenses in detoxification, go to the detoxification interview on Ask Dr. Dawn with Dr. Jeffrey Bland. The date on that one is April 22nd, 2006. This is, I believe, one of the better descriptions of how your body detoxifies, and I think it's accessible and understandable even for people who don't have a PhD in a science area. Now, on to the type of fire retardants that get sprayed out of helicopters on wildfires. There's two types, again, more breaking down. The sort of let's put out this fire, and then the types of fire retardants that are designed to sit on the ground and actually slow the formation of a new fire. The short-term fire retardants are basically detergents, which is to say a surfactant mixed with water to act as a foam. So they have a smothering action. The main issue with any kind of spray like that is the surfactant, because surfactants do have an effect on the mucus and your own pulmonary surfactant. So if you breathe enough of that in, it could act as an irritant. And in fact, the people who mix the tanks that are then taken up by the helicopters and sprayed have industrial reports of short-term pulmonary irritation. But long-term, again, the body is able to deal with these compounds. Then you have the other type of fire retardants, and these are the kinds that are designed to both smother a fire and also have a longer-term deterrent effect. These retardants are, nowadays, pretty much just fertilizer. They used to be borate, which did turn out to be toxic to the environment and was dropped. Now they're compounds like ammonium phosphate, diammonium sulfate, diammonium phosphate, monoammonium phosphate, and clay, and also guar gum, which is a food product, and so I'm not too worried about having that one out there in the environment. Most of these compounds are very, very safe. These are things that are used, as I said, as fertilizers. Plants can break them down. That's always good. Most things that plants can break down, we also possess similar enzymes in our bodies that will help us break them down. So essentially, it's a nitrogenous waste product that has its own recycling system built into the environment. I felt a lot better about fire retardants and the fire retardant chemistry after doing this research. So when I see those guys spraying stuff from helicopters, I'm not so worried anymore. The pigments, by the way, that they use, also not a big deal. Generally iron salts, which are good for you for the most part and not going to create an environmental hazard. I found an excellent website about this. This is from the Victoria, Australia Department of Health. And I will post a link on Ask Dr. Don because it does have a lot of good information about environmental health in the home, particularly in fire areas. Now, I do want to throw out for those of you who are really out in the woods and have a tank, a water tank, if there's a fire and you're evacuating, you should turn off the intake for your tank, disconnect your water tank and make sure the cover's on. And if you have a rainwater tank, you need to install a flush diverter and make sure that you don't drink the rainwater. First of all, you don't let it get into the tank and then that you drain off the first part. And you can taste these fire retardants if they do get into your water. The ammonia and the sulfate really make the water taste terrible. And you know what? That's a biological adaptation in mammals that goes way back. If the water is bad for you, it generally tastes or smells bad for you, bacteria being the exception, of course. If your house was sprayed with fire retardant, this is something that you should try to clean off, and it can be cleaned off with soap and water, mild detergent, but scrub, scrub, scrub. Power washing doesn't do as well. Now, if you have to get up on the roof and scrub it, yep, that's a little bit dangerous. Probably your biggest risk from the fire retardant at that point is falling off the roof and breaking your leg. So if you need to rinse down your house or your walkways, please exercise caution. But if you've got a direct spray, that might not be such a bad idea. So I had an email from one of my regular listeners who pointed me to this article. And this is one of those journals that we all read, Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. No, actually, it comes from Science Daily, August 27th, 2006 posting. The authors of this article, Blaise LeBlanc and Julian Eggleston, have done some research on high fructose corn syrup. A lot of beekeepers feed high fructose corn syrup to their bees, and that's probably where this research came from. They were looking at safety for the bees. As you may know, there have been a number of colonies collapsing, and a mysterious disease has killed like a third of the honeybees in the country, and no one really quite knows what it is. So in researching that, they found that many beekeepers switched to feeding their bees high fructose corn syrup. So they thought, well, could this be causing the colony collapse disorder? And in this article, they studied a high fructose corn syrup and found that if it gets above 120 degrees Fahrenheit, it undergoes a chemical change and forms a substance called hydroxymethylfurfural, which is toxic to bees and potentially toxic to us as well. So I used to make this Coca-Cola chicken where you would cook the, this is a long time ago, folks, where you would use the Coca-Cola as a basting and roast the chicken. It was very tasty. But I would have been, in doing that, producing lots of two things I now know to be quite unhealthy, hydroxymethylfurfural from the high fructose corn syrup in the Coke, and also advanced glycosylated end products, which are proteins with sugar molecules on them, which are also known to be extremely carcinogenic in vitro. They're also very oxidative, so they age your tissues. One of the reasons that diabetics who have poor control of their sugars develop accelerated aging, like early kidney damage, early blindness, early heart disease, is because of the formation of these accelerated glycosylated end products. And just to make it even more fun, if you use barbecue sauce and go and read the ingredients on your barbecue or your teriyaki sauce, folks, you'll see high fructose corn syrup. So if you take that sauce, slather it on your chicken and beef, and then put it on the grill, you are generating a very carcinogenic dish for yourself. So put the barbecue sauce on afterwards if you must, and see if you can find one that's made with something like molasses and not with high fructose corn syrup. And before we go to our first caller, I wanted to throw out something more about unintended consequences and chemical change, and that's tattoo removal. We're bouncing all over the place here, but when you get a tattoo, there's been some controversies published in the past about, you know, how safe are the inks. Well, that's still in debate, but when you have your tattoo removed by hitting it with a laser beam to break down the pigments, there's no longer any debate. Laser light at high intensities destroys the skin pigments and gets rid of the tattoo, but two compounds are formed when you irradiate those dyes, and these are 2-methyl-5-nitroaniline and 4-nitrotoluene. These are extremely toxic and carcinogenic compounds. And this is news. We have a technology of putting tattoos on people now. It's become a common cultural practice. Tattoo removal is also a common cultural practice. I would emphasize again that since tattoo removal produces carcinogenic chemicals in your skin that your body then has to deal with, or that might just sit in your skin and have fun, you want to be sure when you get a tattoo that you really want it. And do know when you get a tattoo that we may find in 5 years or so that one of the dyes used in your tattoo may have cancer-generating properties. So it is not a completely safe thing to be doing. Do I think I'm going to cause a run on the tattoo parlors with this statement? No, I don't. I think people will do what they're going to do. But it's always nice to have a sense that you may be taking a risk, and then you decide to take it. Okay, you're going to die sometime anyway. And let's talk to Robert in Soquel. Hello, Robert, and welcome to the program.
John, good morning. Hey, I'm a tattoo parlor owner, and I'm angry. No, just kidding. those two items, the high corn fructose and the tattoo chemicals, if nothing else was given to us today, those two items are pure gold.
Thank you.
A couple quick questions. Is the use of nitrogen by a dermatologist to burn precancerous stuff, are there any side effects or downsides to that?
Basically, it's a thermal injury, and you're familiar with the other kind of thermal injury, burns, right? And it heals like a burn. So the cells rupture. Instead of boiling away, they burst from being frozen, but the end result is cellular death. Right. So when cells die, they have to regrow. That regrowth process, if there were a mutation in a cell right next door and all this growth hormone is kicking around while you heal a scar or heal a burn, you potentially could kick up a cancer, but that is so rare, and it tends to require repetitive injuries to an area before you see it. So statistically speaking, not a risk. We used to use chemicals, and those chemicals were riskier. Compounds like trichloroacetic acid, and I'm blanking on the name of it. Silver nitrate, that's used to stop bleeding. Sometimes you could use it for that purpose, but you don't usually use it to destroy skin lesions. The nitrogen just gets cold. It's not about the nitrogen being active chemically. Nitrogen is actually a very inert compound for the most part, but it gets cold. And the cold freezes the cells, and they break open when they freeze.
Thank you. Another quick question. Are you aware of an approved alternative therapy to knee replacement?
There are a couple of things that I have seen recently. They are FDA approved. One of them is a cartilage resurfacing technique that, if I understand it correctly, it involves going in and drilling a bunch of tiny little holes in the cartilage and then applying a chemical substance which has the effect in combination of increasing blood flow and creating some vascularization and new deposition of the matrix, which is what cartilage is made of, essentially.
When the cartilage is absent for one reason or another.
Well, if it's completely absent, then you obviously can't reseed the surface. There's also injections of various compounds. There is a synovial fluid analog. It's hyaluronic acid, which is a thick, gooey gel very similar to the gels that you might get at the pharmacy to put in the freezer so that you can apply ice to something that you hurt or to an injury, the ones that remain flexible. And it's non-compressible, so if you fill the knee with that, and one of the trade names is Synovisc, it will really help in some individuals prevent pain. And we don't think it regrows cartilage, but it acts as a lubricant and an anti-inflammatory and somehow improves functioning so that the individual is able to walk a mile. And therefore, if you can walk a mile, you probably don't need a knee replacement.
And how long would that stuff last?
Usually it lasts about a year. When it works, and it doesn't work 50% of the time, or in my own clinical experience, it works in a subgroup of the population. When it does work, it works quite well. There's also a surgical alternative to a total knee replacement where they essentially take a wedge of bone out from your tibia, and that tilts your whole knee surface. And so you tilt the damaged area down and you tilt the good area up. And then you can run off of the good area for a while, maybe a long time. And that's an osteotomy procedure. Those are alternatives to knee replacement. And in younger people, we try to use those first because you can only really count on 20 years with a knee. And if you've got a life expectancy of greater than 20 years, then you're looking at two knee replacements. And the second one is never as easy or as good as the first.
Of course. Are you aware, you can just say yes or no, are you aware of other knee therapies that are not in America that are fairly well accepted, proven?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay. Dr. Don, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We had an off-air question that I wanted to take a moment and discuss, and that is acetyl L-carnitine a good supplement, and what is it for? So I don't know who asked that, but thank you, because this gives me a chance to expound a little bit on biochemistry, which has become one of my favorite subjects since I finally have learned in the last 5 years in my study of functional medicine why on earth they taught me all this biochemistry. But I feel like I've gotten back 3 years of my life because I spent so long learning this stuff and then I had absolutely no clue why. But now I know. So acetyl L-carnitine is one of a class of chemicals. I'm going to start with L-carnitine. Okay, so L-carnitine's an amino acid, and it acts as a carrier for the transport of fat, little tiny two-molecule acyl groups. You want to move that into the mitochondria, basically. Our bodies are capable, through the citric acid cycle, of breaking an oxidative phosphorylation, of generating a whole lot of energy off of a molecule of glucose. That's one of the things that allowed us to beat out the bacteria as the eukaryotes came along. Bacteria work by glycolysis. They don't have mitochondria. So every glucose molecule will produce something like 3 molecules of ATP, which is fine. But if you go through this process of the Krebs cycle and oxidative phosphorylation, a much more complex biochemical process, you get 18 molecules. And in the case of the L-carnitine, its job is to move little 2-carbon fragments into the mitochondria and then take waste products back out so that you have a conveyor belt. The raw material comes in and generates its 18 molecules of ATP and exits the cell as waste product and then shuttles back in. So this happens in all biological cells, all of the cells of your body. The acetyl L-carnitine is the one that seems to get into the brain. And so it's promoted as having effects for Alzheimer's, for cognitive restoration or support. And L-carnitine does get acetylated in the body. So you could just take L-carnitine. You probably don't have to take the more expensive acetyl L-carnitine. People who have heart disease, there's good data that people with congestive heart failure benefit from this. There's good data that people with diabetes benefit, good data that people with dementing disorders, particularly Alzheimer's, has been studied. And benefit from L-carnitine in terms of functioning has been demonstrated in placebo studies, which, given the difficulty of getting statistical significance, I think is quite important. I am being corrected by my PhD biologist producer. Bacteria do oxidative phosphorylation, and so I'm wrong about that. Yes, of course. Anaerobic bacteria, the first ones, were the ones that don't do oxidative phosphorylation, duh. Once OxPhos developed and started producing, and we started having things evolve very rapidly on the planet, and oxygen showed up, that particular biochemical mutation occurred. So my bad, sorry about that, to you archaeobacteriologists out there. Let's go to Judith in Watsonville. Hello, Judith, and thank you for the call.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling it about digestion, and I recently had a complete digestive panel done. It was showing low digestive enzymes, and I'm taking digestive enzymes, and so I can take some more.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have is there any ways, are you aware of any ways to stimulate my own body's ability to make digestive enzymes?
Well, start off with describing digestive enzymes as coming from the pancreas, and as we age, those do tend to reduce. I'm not aware of any herbal agent or other types of products that stimulate the increased production of pancreatic enzymes. That seems to be a place where we start having to basically ask for help from nature. There are plant-derived digestive enzymes that contain proteases and lipases and are not pH-dependent, and those work through the entire digestive tract, but they're weaker and larger doses are needed. There are also pancreatic enzyme products on the market which are animal-derived and are essentially extracts of animal pancreas. These do tend to be much stronger. They are pH-dependent. They don't work in an acidic environment. People who make stomach acid, they need to get through the stomach acid and into the small intestine, and there can be some problems with whether or not they make it without being denatured,
mm-hmm.
and that's debatable. So those are digestive enzymes. Then there are the digestive enzymes that are produced in the stomach, which are hydrochloric acid and pepsin. And those are a different class of enzymes and are often added into digestive enzyme mixes, along with amylase, which is an enzyme that's present in large quantities in saliva and also in the stomach to some extent, and also in the pancreas to some extent. But the different amylases have different profiles in terms of their tolerance for pH. But amylase breaks down starch. So obviously, starch being a large component of our diet, producing glucose when it's finally broken down, it's very adaptive for us to make sure that all of the starch we consume gets broken down into its component glucose molecules. So once you've gotten the stuff broken down into the small molecules, then you've got to absorb it. And probably a lot more people than we realize have problems with absorption of micronutrients across the small intestine. And that can be because of gastric bypass surgery. That can be because of history of colitis. That can be because of unsuspected celiac disease. That can be because of poor blood flow due to vascular disease. So as you can see from this brief description of the process, it rapidly becomes complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I think that looking at that digestive analysis you had, that comes in many, many different flavors. So can you give me more information about what test you had and what it said exactly?
Oh, it had a lot of different things. It measured fungus in my intestine. And
what laboratory did the test?
It's up in Washington.
In Washington. Okay, I'm not sure which lab that was.
Diagnostech, Inc.
Okay.
It was a complete with saliva and the feces.
Okay, so when they look at your digestion, if the conclusion was that it was a pancreatic enzyme issue, it doesn't narrow it down sufficiently for me to give you more specific advice.
Well, there was another thing. There was like low immune function. IgG or IgM.
Was it IgA? Because lots of people have IgA deficiency, and that you can pick up in stool.
Yeah, IgA.
Yeah. So while we're continuing on this, if you have poor IgA excretion, you're more vulnerable to infection. And that also associates with celiac disease, because
uh-huh.
the IgA is coming out of the small intestine as well as the salivary glands. So did the test also include testing for the celiac antibodies?
The gliadin?
No, that wouldn't be the one. That's not the best test to do. So this is complicated, and we're not going to do it on the air. If you want, we can do a phone consult at my regular office, so you can just go to the Ask Dr. Don website and contact the office,
uh-huh.
and we'll set up a phone consult, and I'll try to help you with this. I'm surprised that the person who ordered it hasn't sat down and done a thorough analysis with you, but I'd be happy to provide that service, but not on the air. It's not interesting enough to the rest of the audience.
Yeah, right. No, I thought the question about enzymes might be interesting.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's take an email. This is from Tara Ochoa in Hinsville, Georgia. And Tara had emailed me a while back and I did not respond, so she sent it again. And that's, by the way, a good strategy. I have so many emails, I don't get to them all, and then I sort of mislay the ones that are backlogged. So, dear Dr. Don, I have some facial hair on my chin and upper lip since age 16. I'm now 39. It seemed to start while I was pretty thin. I'm always been a runner, but was running around 80 miles a week at that time in competitive cross-country and track. My mom took me to an endocrinologist due to the fact that I was not getting a period anymore. He tested my hormones and found that my estrogen level was that of a postmenopausal woman. I took Premarin and Provera for a while and gained some weight. The periods returned, but the hair growth never went away. I've done electrolysis, waxing, Vanica, and currently have just resorted to tweezing. I'm not underweight, still run 20 to 30 miles a week. Any suggestions other than prescription drugs or hair removal, which is too expensive? I don't take any medicines. Well, yes, Georgia, actually, at the age that you have reached now of 39, there are some things you might be able to do biochemically that could be helpful that are herbs. And the first one I'm going to talk about is saw palmetto, which is traditionally thought of as a herb for men. It changes an enzyme that turns testosterone into dihydrotestosterone, which is the version of testosterone that actually activates hair growth. So the hair follicles don't have testosterone receptors, they have dihydrotestosterone receptors. And in your scalp, if you're a male with a family propensity to male pattern baldness, that DHT will actually cause your follicles to shut down. If you're a female and you have higher levels of DHT in your system, you will tend to grow hair in the male areas, which is basically the chest and the face. So blocking that with an herb is a strategy. And in general, DHT blockage doesn't have any known adverse effects in females. So you could try something as simple as saw palmetto. Another DHT conversion blocker is progesterone. And many, many women at your age group are using progesterone creams for the putative benefit of bone preservation or for other purposes. Most of these creams are derived from a yam, Mexican wild yam, and they do contain bioidentical progesterone. As long as you're cycling regularly, a small amount of progesterone cream is probably not going to mess up your cycles. And it might be something that could be applied just to the areas where you're having the hair growth. And these creams are available commercially. Progest is a good brand that might be findable in Georgia where you live. And I would probably start with those strategies, topical agents or simple herbs, before going to pharmaceuticals myself. So I hope you found that helpful. And we're going now to Lucia in Hollister. Hi.
The reason I'm calling is actually coincidentally the opposite, hair loss.
Uh-huh.
When I, you know, shower, wash my hair. And even after, I lose a lot of hair. And so I'm wondering what's the cause of that.
Do you have long hair?
Yes, I do. It's like, well, shoulder length.
And how old are you?
I'm 60.
60.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about the women, your grandmothers. Did you know them? Did they have thin hair when they reached their 60s and 70s?
My maternal grandmother did. I don't know much about my paternal grandmother.
Okay. So there is a possibility that this is just genetically programmed hair loss.
Okay.
And there's nothing you can do about your genetics at this point. We just don't have drugs for that.
Okay.
It's also possible that you may have developed hypothyroidism, which is extremely common in our country. And a low thyroid, even a borderline low thyroid, will affect your hair growth, and you will have effectively thinning of your hair, and also often a change in texture of the hair. So that's another clue. And you can get your thyroid checked. You want to be sure that you check the T4 and the T3. And we've talked on the show, if you look in the archives, you'll find lots of information about complete thyroid testing.
Okay.
So I'll direct you there as a resource. The other possibility that comes to mind is that at the point that you start losing hair, rewind mentally 3 months and ask yourself, did you have the flu? Did you have a sudden emotional shock? Did you have a bereavement? Something that would be a real physical stressor. Because there's a natural mechanism in our bodies, which is that 3 months after we have a physiological stressor, a bad one, we will lose a lot of hair for a couple of months. And that's because the hair that was growing 3 months previously got shunted into the resting phase. And hair will rest for about 3 months and then fall out. So as long as it's growing, it stays on. Once it gets kicked into resting, it's got a time limit, and it's going to drop out 3 months after it starts to rest, give or take. So think about 3 months ago. The good news is if you did have a shock or a physiologic stressor, and then 3 months later you start losing hair, call it 2 to 4 months, you know, give it a range, but then it's going to stop, and you'll have recovery about 6 months out.
Okay.
If it's a slow, insidious process and your thyroid checks out normal, you may be looking at genetic programming. That type of programming, by the way, does come in through the X chromosome. So if a man's mother's brother was bald, then he's got the probability of becoming bald.
I'm sorry, mom's brother, said?
Yeah, well, if a man's worried about, is he going to go bald? My question is, your maternal uncle, tell me about him, because your father's side doesn't contribute to your genetic risk of going bald.
The surviving uncle is balding. Not, you know, completely, but he is balding,
So it sounds like you've got the DNA. And it could just be that.
Okay.
All right, good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Great show. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And for Lucia, the May 16th, 2009 show is the most recent one that talks about the thyroid testing. That's May 16th, 2009, and that's in the archives at Ask Dr. Dawn. So another email that I received, this one from Jane Wade, a former regular contributor to our programming here on KUSP, has sent me this thing about cleaning water in a purifying method called SODIS. This is something she heard on public radio, didn't remember the program. My producer, Charlie, was able to find it. And the technique is a third world technique. Now, back in the day when I was first training in medicine, I had the ambition of going off to the third world and helping in developing countries with healthcare. And I could talk about that for hours, but one of the things that I did in reading and learning about that was come to the conclusion or discovery, not really my discovery, mind you, but you know, get it through your dumb little naive head, Don. Clean water is one of the key things that people in developing countries need. Access to clean water is still threatened 40 years after I began reading about it. And now what we've got is people all over the world whose water rights have been sold or leased by the government and who are prohibited from collecting rainwater because that impinges on the right of these companies to sell them back water. Now, that's just nuts. But on to the topic that Jane brought to our attention. The technique here, you take a large plastic soda or water bottle and you pour water into them, close the cap, and put them on the roof in a sunny place for a couple of days. And the heat coming through that plastic water bottle disinfects it. Now, this is bacterial disinfection, so it kills the bacteria, making the water safe to drink in areas where there isn't enough wood to boil water. And it's a very interesting study, and the article kind of talks about problems with getting people to actually do that in developing countries. That's not our topic here, but what I think is interesting is just to muse for a moment about sunlight and plastic water bottles. We've talked about the leaching of the plasticizers and the other chemicals, the hormone mimics, into water when it's in plastic water bottles. And of course, that lovely discovery that bisphenol A from Nalgene and other supposedly inert plastics gets into your water has gotten all of us a little bit freaked out about water in plastic bottles. Here we are taking plastic bottles and deliberately subjecting them to heat stress. And that water that the people drink, while pure of bacteria, is going to have higher contents of plasticizers and softeners and other compounds, which in large doses are probably not great for you. So this is a classic example of taking a small risk to avoid a large risk. And I think in context, this is a very appropriate water purification method in areas that are ecologically stressed and economically stressed. And it's a good solution. I'm completely not against it. A very, very dear friend of mine once told me about the wisdom that his father had taught him. And his father said that all actions need to be considered in terms of the place, the time, and the circumstance before they're judged as either right or wrong. And this is one of those things that we often lose sight of when we talk about chemicals and the toxicity of this compound or other in the environment. So I think it's a good idea just at this moment to bring a little bit of common sense into the perspective. Not too much, but just a little. If the hillside is burning and the fire is heading for your house, the fire is going to kill you much more quickly than the fire retardant. And you should accept and be glad of the fire retardant. In the situation where the bacteria have contaminated your water and you're dealing with not getting cholera, you should accept and be grateful for the plastic water bottles that can kill the cholera. And incidentally, the price you pay is exposure to these chemical compounds, which if you get enough water, your body will probably be able to detoxify. And if it shortens your life expectancy by 1 year and extends your life expectancy by 30, it's a good trade-off. And everything in life is a trade-off. Let's go to Moon in Santa Cruz. Hello, Moon, and welcome to the show.
Hi there. Well, you were just talking about water purification in plastic bottles, which is interesting. But I was wondering if the same process could be done in glass, thereby avoiding all the leaching problems.
Yes, I think it probably could. There are issues of breakage and cost and weight that complicate it. Mainly breakage. I mean, one of the sad things is the plastic water bottles are everywhere in the developing world, and glass bottles are very hard to find and expensive. And then if we want to get really holistic, we can talk about the carbon footprint issue of hauling around and distributing water bottles that are made of glass, but we're not going to go there today.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks.
Thank you very much for the comment.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Just
jumping way off into a different topic, I wanted to spend a moment telling you about a new discovery or a new piece of research that contradicts. I love it when everything we know is wrong. So the stuff that I was taught in medical school to tell people and the stuff that the people 5 years ago or 2 years ago or 6 months ago were told to do or not do. And somebody actually says, I wonder if that's correct, and tests it. And lo and behold, it's not correct. Now, the thing I love about science, and I so love this about science and medical science, is when somebody demonstrates this, we actually change the advice. And that's just so different from most other fields of endeavor that it needs to be celebrated. A couple weeks ago, the New England Journal of Medicine published a study of breast cancer patients who had lymphedema. Lymphedema is an unnatural swelling of an arm or a leg that is caused by damage to the lymph tissues. We don't really think about our lymph tissues as much as we should. We don't appreciate them and celebrate them. But you've all heard of elephantiasis, which is this disease where the person's leg or blows up to humongous sizes or other organs as well. And that is purely because the parasite blocks the lymph drainage. So with absolutely no lymph drainage, the storm drains back up and the tissue puffs up. Your veins are only capable of pulling so much fluid back into the bloodstream. The rest of it is brought back into your bloodstream through this complex network of very, very tiny, thin-walled vessels called the lymph tissue. And because the lymph tissue is essentially recycling moisture that oozes out of your capillaries, carrying sugar and oxygen, I might add, the moisture also is carrying any bacterial antigens or compounds that could hurt you if it got back into the bloodstream. So the lymph tissue also serves as a fundamental part of your immune system in that the lymph nodes filter those channels of lymph. And if it encounters a bacterial antigen or viral toxin it recognizes, it blows up, calls in a bunch of white cells, and starts fighting to keep that infection local and keep it out of the bloodstream. So that's the lymph system. Now, when you get cancer, sometimes you have to remove the lymph tissue because the lymph tissue has become infected with the cancer. When you use chemotherapy or radiation, Sometimes you burn or damage the lymph tissue and cause it to scar shut. And so people will get swelling on the other side of that scarring, usually on the hand or the arm. We have always told women who have lymphedema after breast cancer surgery and chemo to avoid using the arm. We don't let anybody draw blood on that arm. We don't put a blood pressure cuff on that arm. And most importantly, we tell them not to use the arm for physical activity. Ironically, that's bad advice. In this study, they had 141 patients. Half were given traditional restrictions. The other half were put on a slow, progressive program of gradual weightlifting. They start off lifting light weights, and they work their way up and lift heavier and heavier weights. And the women who did the gradual weightlifting did much better in terms of flare-ups of their lymphedema. So we now need to still not do the IV lines, but we probably can carry babies, purses, and maybe even get our blood pressure taken on a lymphedemic arm without causing any harm. So the physical therapy programs were also published. It's a fairly straightforward issue, and it doesn't seem to matter how far out you are from your surgery. So those of you out there with lymphedema and suffering from the compression, it's time to talk to your doctor about maybe revisiting slow, gradual physical therapy as a solution for this really disabling problem. Let's talk to Richard in San Jose. Hello, Richard. Welcome to the program.
How you doing? I have a nephew who was knocked out, and they say he had some sort of a trauma to the brain. But now, after 2 years later, they've diagnosed him with a paranoid schizophrenic, and he's in the hospital now, and they're trying to figure out how to treat him.
How old is he?
He's 23 years old.
Did anyone else in the family ever have schizophrenia?
We're researching that now, but the opinion is no.
Okay, go ahead.
No, that's the question. I don't know. An injury like some sort of a brain injury being just simply knocked out, knocked out for a few minutes in a sports game, and then 2 years later be diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic?
I don't think that there's any data that shows that there's a connection. You're talking about two fairly common events. Although we don't like to think about it, schizophrenia is actually present diagnosably in 1% of the population.
And wow.
I know, it's a much bigger number than most people realize. If you're a young man playing football or basketball, the frequency of head injury isn't all that rare either. Getting knocked out probably occurs, I don't know, off the top of my head, I'd say that 1 out of 500 people has probably been knocked unconscious in their life. And most of those are going to be front-loaded in your youth and when you're doing crazy stuff and playing sports.
Yeah.
So that's too much overlap just on the basis of flip a coin for me to be too worried in a single case. And epidemiologically, I don't think there's any trend data, particularly if it's 2 years before the onset of schizophrenia. I should expect that if there were brain damage, a seizure disorder or something like that might show up many years later. A seizure disorder is a much more localized problem. Schizophrenia is more of a physiological issue, and it really does seem to be more of a holographic issue in terms of how the brain is processing information. And it's kind of difficult to imagine that you could remove that physiological adaptation, the normal version of it, with a head blow. I suppose it's possible, but I don't think that that's it. I have a feeling it's just a coincidence.
Yeah, and the medications that they give for that, I mean, he's highly medicated right now.
Yeah.
What do those affect? Other side effects?
They mainly affect a neurotransmitter called dopamine. And dopamine has a lot of effects in the brain. It's part of a lot of control feedback loops related to addiction behavior, related to movement, related to reward, related to memory. You get the idea that it's pretty complicated? Yeah, it is. But in general, when you alter the metabolism of dopamine, it tends to improve schizophrenic symptoms at the cost of messing with other symptoms. So there tends to be weight gain with these drugs, quite a lot of weight gain. That probably affects the appetite and satiety piece. There tends to be an overall slowing of mental processes. So you get a little stupider, a little slowed down. And with some of the drugs, you get way slowed down. But even with the best of them, a little slowed down is common. And long-term, the big concern is movement disorders, because the part of the brain that controls things like facial movement or the coordination of movement, there's an area
that when it's damaged, we call that Parkinson's disease.
Mm.
And you've heard, I'm sure, of Parkinson's disease. And that's
yes.
mainly a loss of dopamine neurons in one place. So it's a localized loss, so you get a very localized problem. But if you give a drug that interferes with dopamine, eventually you can get Parkinson-like symptoms in people who take these drugs for long term. So we've got all these new drugs. Well, we don't have as high an incidence, or we don't have tardive dyskinesia. We don't have these movement disorders. Well, maybe you don't have them now, but maybe in 20 years you'll turn out to be having them. And we just don't know that yet. This is a great question because it really feeds into the whole risk-benefit thing that I was
right.
talking about. Because when you've got paranoid schizophrenia, you are so disabled. You're not going to have anything resembling a normal life.
No.
And so if your brain is dysfunctional to that extent, society and the family needs to make the choice. Are we going to let this individual be in their own little world and have whatever quality of life is achievable in a contained environment? Or are we going to medicate them and create an impaired but functional version of Jackie that can at least, you know, have relationships and hold down a job and have a meaningful social existence? You know, I think you go with choice B, even understanding that there's a cost. Because the cost of
right.
not doing something is greater than the cost of doing something.
You're right. And that's the decision that the caseworker, the person who's taking care of him, is trying to make for them, is because he's an adult and he's pretty much in the hospital against his will. But they have to make a decision to let him out in the real world. He has to be on medication.
Yeah, and people are classically non-compliant with their medications.
That's exactly, you hit it right on the head.
Yeah.
You know, if he gets out and changes his medication or decides not to, an adult, you know, he can just do what he wants. All of a sudden now he's going to be back in there again. And
yeah, and also he may have hurt somebody in the process, although that is rare. Paranoid schizophrenia yeah. is the disease where people actually do injury to others.
Yeah,
most forms of imagining
things, you know.
Yeah, and you know, you lash out to protect yourself. And most people who have mental illness, and I really want to emphasize this, most people with mental illness are less dangerous than the sane people, because sane people are more capable of a coordinated behavior
and
plotting and planning and all the things that make you effective in creating injury. But that being said, paranoid schizophrenia is the exception to that statement. And we have methods, we have our ways, we have depot versions of these drugs that are given by injection once every 3 to 4 weeks. And essentially, it's like being on parole. You know, you show up and you meet with your parole officer and you get your shot. Then 4 weeks later, if you don't show up, they send out the sheriff and find you. That's better than nothing, and at least it lets him be out in the community. All sorts of social advocacy and rights and bioethical issues emerge in this discussion, and we're winding up the hour and don't have time to do more than scratch the surface. But I want to thank you for bringing this point up, and I do think it's something we could all spend some time thinking about.
Thank you.
What are the rights? What rights do we have as family or friends to insist that someone get help? And or do we just wash our hands of them? And what's the more responsible course?
Yeah, and on Tuesday, the court decides whether he stays in or not. He doesn't have a choice.
You know, I have a lot of faith in our court system, and I think that our judges and the people who are working at that level in society are doing a very good job in trying to be fair and honest.
Yep,
and so
I agree.
I want to thank them for their hard work, and thank you for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We've come to the end of another hour of Ask Dr. Dawn, and I hope that you will join us next week for more of the same. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and where's my music? There it is. So long, and stay healthy.